Hello, welcome to the Marketing Meetup Podcast. I'm Joe. Thank you so much for listening today. Today we have another Joe, Joe Lane, who is the CPO and former CMO of the incredible chocolate brand Tony's Chocolonely, a fantastic brand that started out of the Netherlands and has since expanded all across Europe, but also in the UK and the United States. In this session, Jo speaks through some of the lessons that she has learned in her time at Tony's, really giving us a deep dive behind the story and the consistency in which they've been able to present themselves to the world, very much fueled by their founding story. It's a really, really brilliant case study in how a company can be both commercially successful and also do good for the world and the planet and people within it. It's really lovely, and to continue elevating these examples feels important. Before I pass over to Joe, who starts with a quick story about how the marketing meetup started, how Tony's Chocolonely started, I want to say a big thank you to our featured sponsor this week, who is Cambridge Marketing College. Cambridge Marketing College are the place that you would go to if you want your CIM qualifications, your CIPR qualifications, and a whole bevy of other accredited courses. The thing I really like about Cambridge Marketing College is that, very much in the theme of today's episode, they're also really doubling down in the sustainability space. So for any marketers wanting to learn how to become more sustainable or incorporate sustainable actions into your activity, then it's a really great opportunity to learn way more about that with Cambridge Marketing College. If you head to marketingcollege.com, that's how long they've been around, that they've got a brilliant domain name like that, then you'll be able to find out way more. Now it's time to pass over to Joe, who will speak through the beginning of Tony's Chocolonely, speaking through to their story. This element did have visuals with it, and you'll be able to find the video on the Marketing Meetup website. But the way that Joe speaks through it, I think you'll very much get the impression of what she's speaking about in any case. With all that said, I really hope you enjoy, and I'll see you soon.
Great. So yeah, I'm going to kick off with a very short presentation. I've probably only got 15 minutes or so of slides, and then we can have a good natter at the end. So yeah, this is start introducing myself. Hi everybody, I'm Joe. Where am I at the moment? I am in sunny Cambridge. I saw someone else was in Cambridge as well. The sun is shining, which makes a change. And I've been at Tony's for nearly 3 years. Before that, I was at Innocent Drink. So I started my marketing career with a purpose-led brand. I was there for about 15, 16 years in the end. So Innocent and Tony's is where I learned my craft. But yeah, I'm here to talk about Tony's to start with. So we are crazy about chocolate and serious about people. We make amazing tasting chocolate. We have a really serious mission at our hearts. And that's where I want to start today. I'm going to tell you a little story, a story about chocolate, about change, about choices. Oh, now I can't move my slides. There we go, seamless. Right. So first things first, Tony's Chocolonely is an impact company that makes chocolate, not the other way around. Everything we do is about making impact, about making a difference to the cocoa farmers and their families in West Africa, about doing business the right and the fair way and speaking out boldly when that doesn't happen. And it guides all of our choices. But let me talk to you about where it all starts first. And it starts with growing cocoa. So cocoa grows on cocoa trees, and those cocoa trees grow best around the equator where it's really hot. And the majority of all cocoa nowadays is grown in West Africa. And you can see on this little chart there, you can see the countries on that kind of West Africa tip. And there's all grown on small farms. There's no big, massive plantations. They're all family-run farms. They're about 1 to 2 hectares in size, and there's millions of them. There's about 2.5 million of these cocoa farms. On the other end of that value chain, there's billions of consumers. You, me, Joe, everyone who likes chocolate, just for what it is, like a delicious treat. But in the middle, there's only really a very small handful of big chocolate companies that actually produce chocolate from those cocoa beans. There's not more than about 10 companies worldwide that produce 90% of the chocolate that that the whole world enjoys. And that means that all the power and all the profit sits in that middle section. And we call it that sideways hourglass. It's in the interests of these big companies that the price of cocoa stays low, inhumanely low. So if, for example, a bar of chocolate costs about €2.80, and this was before all the recent inflation, this slide was written, but about 16 cents of that goes to the farmer and his family. So that's about 5 to 6% of the retail price. And that basically means that those farmers in Ghana or the Ivory Coast in West Africa, where they're supporting their whole family from this cocoa farm, have about 72 cents per person per day. And that's way below the extreme poverty level for a country like Ivory Coast. So what does that extreme poverty mean? It means that adults who are running these farms have to rely on their children to work on the farms. They can't afford professional labor. They can't afford machineries to work their farms. So they use their children. And the latest reports show that there's over 1.5 million children working on cocoa farms. So if you remember those 2.5 million farms that I talked about, that means that over 1 in 2 households in Ghana and Ivory Coast have used their children on their farms as their permanent labor source. This isn't just kids coming home from school and helping mum and dad on the cocoa farm for a couple of hours after school. That would be fine. This isn't that. This is them working all day long, dangerous forms of work. So using machetes, dangerous and sharp tools, spraying pesticides, working long hours in the searing equator heat. And I was there in January, and I tell you, it is absolutely sweltering. They're lifting extremely heavy loads, like 60 kilogram bags of cocoa beans on their back, and they're not in school. So this child labor it's horrible. It's really pressing, and it's caused purely by poverty and the price that is paid for cocoa. So you'd have thought, but there's only those handful of companies in that middle bit, in the middle of that hourglass, that control all that power and all that profit, that it should be easy for them to get together and fix it. And yes, and actually in 2001, there were two American senators, Senator Harkin and Senator Engel, who thought that way. And they set up the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which was aimed at eradicating the worst forms of child labor from cocoa in 5 years. And that Harkin-Engel Protocol was signed by all the big major cocoa players and all the big chocolate firms. And you think, hallelujah, we're there, sorted. Unfortunately, it was non-binding, and it required all of these big cocoa industries and chocolate companies to regulate themselves. And they did nothing. So here we are, a few years later. So back in 2005, and this is where you'll start to hear the story of where we came from. So there was a Dutch TV show. It was called Food Unwrapped. It was a bit like, it's like an investigative journalist program with a guy called Turn. Remember that name? Because that's where Tony comes from. And they look at the truth behind food marketing and some of the shady stories in food supply chains. And he was looking into chocolate. And he was shocked that in 5 years after that Harkin-Engel Protocol had been signed, nothing had changed. And even worse, there hadn't even been anything to trigger or drive or start a change process. So Turn tried to talk to all these chocolate companies to make a story for his television program, but surprisingly enough, they didn't want to talk to him about the child labor in their supply chains. So he had another idea. He bought himself 10 different branded chocolate bars from 10 different companies so that he was sure somewhere in that value chain of those 10 chocolate bars, there would have been child labor. He put the video camera on himself and he filmed himself eating a bite of each of those 10 bars. He then took that video and turned himself into the police, saying that he was a chocolate criminal. He had knowingly consumed chocolate that had used child labor and they should arrest him. They didn't take him seriously. But he didn't stop there. So he hired himself a really expensive lawyer and he sued himself. He went to trial, he went through the Dutch courts, and obviously all the newspapers were writing about him, so it was all over the press. And the judge at the end of this lengthy trial said, well, actually, Tin, morally, you are right. But if I prosecute you, I have to prosecute everybody in the Netherlands who's ever eaten chocolate, and that's impossible. So the case got thrown out of court. So what Tin decided to do then was to set an example. He created 5,000 chocolate bars in an alarming red packaging when all of the chocolate in the Netherlands was blue. So he was zigging when they were zagging. And he used only cocoa beans that he could trace back to cocoa farms that he was sure didn't have child labour in. And so Tony's Chocolonely was born. Tony's is the international name for Tern, and Chocolonely for his lonely battle in the chocolate industry. And Tony's growth over the last nearly 20 years has been built on this principle. This year will be nearly 200 million in revenue, and we still work so closely with every single farmer that we source our cocoa from and pay a higher price that we are still eradicating child labour from our supply chain. And we've got the data that shows that it's working. So if you're looking for child labour, the industry average is this pie chart on the left-hand side of the screen, so just under 50%. So like I talked about, one in two children in cocoa farms in West Africa are working on their farm day in, day out. Where we source our cocoa from and the cooperatives that we've been working with for a number of years, and we've implemented our five sourcing principles, we see child labour rates of below 4%. Doesn't mean it's zero, but we actually think that's a good thing. It means that we are finding those children, we're helping them. If you go look for it, you can't help it. And this is our kind of strategy on a page. So that yellow button there is the stamp that goes on all cocoa that we source. And you can see it on our chocolate bars just here. And it says, together we'll end exploitation in cocoa, which is our mission statement. And then we've got our three pillar strategy. So creating awareness, because ultimately that's the first thing we do, because ultimately we're convinced that when consumers and customers start asking and understanding what's in their shopping baskets and on their shelves, and start demanding fairer chocolate, the chocolate producers themselves, those big companies in that middle of the hourglass, are going to feel the pressure to take responsibility. The second one is that we lead by example. We want to set the right example and show that amazing tasting chocolate can be produced in a different way. And the third one is inspiring to act. We, despite our amazing growth, we're still tiny in a very, very busy, huge chocolate category. We aren't going to solve this problem on our own. We need to do it together. So we want others to take action. And we quite honestly welcome anybody to blatantly follow, copy, or even improve on the way that we do it. And that, our mission, is at the heart of everything we do and drives every little decision across the whole business and across our brands. So I'm just going to give you a couple of examples of how that comes to life. So the first thing is our design. So we incorporate the message about inequality in cocoa in everything we do. So this is the most obvious example. So for centuries, chocolate bars were made in boring little square blocks, like an Excel spreadsheet, I guess. Quite often with the name of the producer on each piece, it's Cadbury's or Milka. Really boring, really obvious. And no market research is ever going to tell you that you should break that category code, that you should do something different. But we did. So if you were to open, I don't know who's got chocolate here at 10 to 10 in the morning, I'd be quite impressed. But if you were to open a Tony's chocolate bar, you'll see that every single bar we've got has an equally divided pieces. They're not in squares. They're all different shapes and sizes. And that reflects the inequality in chocolate. So therefore our chocolate bars tell our story in its kind of purest form. And they kind of become a discussion piece. When you unwrap it with friends. And I know it is also annoying to any parents of multiple children anywhere trying to share chocolate equally. But until the chocolate industry is equally divided and the profits and the power are shared equally across that value chain, we're going to keep things unequally divided. The other thing that our mission drives is clearly our supply chain. So I touched a little bit earlier on our kind of sourcing principles. We've got five of them. There are recipes, there are rules for how, if you implement all of these five things, how you can eradicate child labour and exploitation from your cocoa supply chain. And we've got the data to prove that it works. So traceability, paying a higher price, working with the farmers, making sure you're signing up for long-term deals, and then helping them improve the quality and productivity of their farms. Those five things together are what get you the results. But we know, as I mentioned before, that we can't do it on our own. So we have an arm of our business. It's called Tony's Open Chain. It's a website, it's a platform, it's a supply chain, and it's completely open book, and it shares our secrets. So it shares our sourcing policy with anybody who makes chocolate and anybody who buys cocoa. It shares our formula. It tells you exactly how we do it. So rather than keep that kind of USP a secret, because our purpose is to eradicate exploitation, we know we need other people to copy it and we need them to work together. So we've opened everything up. And if any chocolate company or anybody who buys cocoa wants some help to do it, because let's be honest, it can be quite complicated, we'll do it for them. So they can join Tony's Open Chain. They can become a mission ally and we source their cocoa for them. And then they can put that yellow stamp onto their packaging. And that in itself has opened some amazing marketing doors. So last year we partnered with the legends of Ben and Jerry's because they realized that our cocoa sourcing policies were gold standard and better than even Unilever, who owns them, could do. So they joined Tony's Open Chain and they, for the next 5 years, have committed to sourcing all the cocoa that goes into their rice cream through Tony's Open Chain. So of course, we thought we'd better tell people about this. So we ran a big marketing campaign. We partnered Ben and Jerry's to do it together. It's called the Chocolate Love Affair. And the tagline, better when working together to make chocolate 100% slave-free. And we launched complimentary MPD. So Ben and Jerry's launched ice cream using our, inspired by our milk caramel sea salt kind of best-selling flavor. And we launched chocolate inspired by Ben and Jerry's chocolate fudge brownie and strawberry cheesecake bars. And that's the one I was just noticed off, don't have it with me. But that was all down to our mission, being able to partner with an amazing brand like Ben and Jerry's and then use the power of that story to bring it to life. And then talking about campaigns, what else is our mission kind of triggered in terms of creative and ideas? So it also drives our marketing campaigns, and these are a couple from this year. So on the left-hand side, you can see our NPD launch. We launched Little Bits, which are bagged chocolate. And you can see here a window in Whole Foods Kensington, which we took over. And we wrote the word balls and we wrote the word exploitation on a posh shopping street in London. And then on the right-hand side, you can see, I don't know if you saw it recently, it was only, gosh, it's half term. We did a campaign in Germany called Sweet Solutions. And we decided that we would copy the big chocolate companies in their products until they copied us by paying a higher price. So we launched 4 chocolate bars, replicating some big competitors with replicated flavors and replicated wrapper designs. You can see them at the bottom of that. You can see a Twix and you can see a Ferrero and you can see a Kit Kat. And we did all the legal checks to check we weren't doing anything particularly naughty. However, Mondelez got a bit upset about the color purple. So they issued us a writ. And after a frantic 24 hours, we withdrew the purple bar and we launched a gray bar. So you can see the Milka. This used to be a Milka bar and you can see the Milka mountains. And then we just made it gray with a tagline of pay farmers, not lawyers. And quite honestly, that went absolutely viral. So it was just in Germany. We spent 200 grand on that total campaign, including all the legal fees. And it ended up all over the BBC and the Sunday Times. It crossed borders. So that's purely because we believe that all of these big chocolate companies should be paying their cocoa farmers a higher price. And that's what triggered that campaign idea. And then it also drives our product choices. So if you've been in any retailer over Christmas, you'd have seen our enormous advent calendar. It's too big, it doesn't fit on the shelves, which makes the retailers a bit cross. But the actual interesting thing about it is that it represents the inequality in the cocoa supply chain, just like our bars do. So there's still 25 chocolates in this advent calendar, but one day we put nothing. So behind a little window, there was no chocolate. On another day, we put 2. So we just spread out the chocolates unequally. And we got such amount of consumer feedback, mostly positive, with people going, wow, you have taught me about inequality and I'm now teaching my children about that it's not fair. And we also ended up on the second red mark article on the BBC News, just beaten by an Omicron variant. So some pretty cool coverage from launching a rather large advent calendar. And then just to end, before I kind of open the questions, this is a quote that I really love from Anita Woodick at The Body Shop. If you think you're too small to have an impact, try going to bed with a mosquito in the room. And Tony started in the Netherlands 19 years ago. It launched in the UK 5 years ago. We have tiny marketing budgets. And the first 15 years of the business, we had a no paid media strategy and all of our reach was through other channels. So just remember, if you're too small to have an impact, try going to bed with a mosquito in the room. That, my friends, is that. So I will try and stop sharing. There we go. Super.
Just incredible, Joe. Like, you may not have seen the chat feature throughout the duration of the presentation. No. But like, you have been going, a lot of people saying how incredible that is. So thank you so
good. Much. I'm glad.
For priming that with that story, really incredible. You might be able to see it right now. Lots of praise, folks. I'm gonna do something which we don't usually do, which is I'm gonna head to the Q&A from the community more or less straight away, because like I know that you'll have some amazing questions. With that thought in mind, if you want to use the Q&A feature, it's found down below, and give a thumbs up to the ones which you'd love me to answer, so that we can make sure that we prioritize that. While you're doing that, however, I'm just going to sort of speak to probably not the elephant in the room, but certainly something which is a really interesting marketing challenge, which is like, people speak about purpose all the time over here, and then they sort of speak about commercialism over here. And like, they're always sort of seen as opposites somehow. And I guess there are so many different ways to answer this question, but like, I guess I want to make it really, really open to start off with just a question about how you manage that sort of tension between purpose and commercialism at Tony's, because presumably you've got to do both.
Yeah. And it's such a good question. And one of the first slides that I started with was about our Crazy About Chocolate series about people, which essentially sums up that tension. We want to make great tasting chocolate that consumers love, but at the same time, we've got a really serious mission behind us. And I think the beautiful thing about this particular brand is that they are so intertwined that actually that tension doesn't materialize in the business particularly, because ultimately, the more chocolate we sell, the more beans we buy, the more impact we make, because they're so perfectly aligned that we actually don't have that much tension between the two. They tend to go hand in hand. I think the only tension, if I'm really honest, the only tension we have is when I touched on Tony's Open Chain, and it becomes a resource question. Are we trying to, we've got a finite amount of resource, are we trying to grow Tony's Open Chain through having more mission allies and other partners join us and that impact on the ground? Or are we trying to grow our business fast and hard? We want both. And then it's a choice of which goes fast at which different points. Nice. But actually in this, it's one of the reasons I chose to join the brand. I just chose to join the business. It's so powerful and so tightly linked that, yeah, I think it's quite unique in that space.
I love that as a lesson, because I think it's one of these things that, once again, you know, sort of speaking about that purposeful thing, you know, so many folks want to work for a purposeful brand or want to do purpose things, but will sort of try and tag it on. And so, you know, even by implication of everything you've just said, it's like, if you want to do purpose, you know, and link it in with everything. So that tension point doesn't occur, which, you know, is really, really important. I mean, do you have any sense of like why people buy the chocolate? Is it because of the purpose-led thing, or is it because it's good chocolate?
Sorry, the second. Yeah, I think, chocolate is a impulse-led category. You don't write it on your shopping list, do you? You buy it when you're at the checkout or you're hungry. It's not such a considered purchase. And it is done primarily through, I want to treat myself, or I'm hungry and I want something that tastes delicious. So that is the first kind of purchase driver. And then in terms of how many people understand our mission in that detail that I've just talked to, very, very few. I think we definitely have a halo of we are a good brand. We do good in the world, but the specifics of what actually that is and what that looks like, that hasn't, no matter how pointed we are in our communication, ultimately people buy chocolate because it tastes great. And that's why this is, it does, I mean, the most important thing, it's got to taste bloody brilliant.
So true. We've got Louise in the chat who's saying, I first bought Tony's chocolate because I'd heard about the purpose, but then I was completely converted into being a loyal customer because it was absolutely delicious. So slightly inverse.
I just saw one that said, I do write chocolate on my shopping list. I'm like, I love you. Thank you. Good for you.
I want to pick up on one last element from the presentation, because I can see that there's 35 open questions right now. So we want to make sure that we prioritize those, which is that thing about picking an enemy. And so, like, I feel like when you sort of have been calling out the incumbent brands and sort of saying, you know, you need to do better and stuff like that. But at the same time, you've also got a call to action to them, which is join the open chain, you know, and sort of join us.
Yeah.
What do the discussions look like internally about that sort of, like, you know, sort of calling folks out versus sort of bringing them in?
Yeah, it's a, that is, and when you talk about tension, that actually is a genuine one. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and it's a line we have to tread very carefully on, because we do want to work together and we do want to drive wider change, and that does require everybody to join, but at the same time they're not doing it quickly enough and they're not doing it well enough. So the line that we try to take on that is speed and urgency, because yes, all of the people who work at these big chocolate companies, it's of course, they're all good humans. I'm sure they all would love to live in a fair, equitable world. And they also, in their vision statements, have a similar vision statement of a fair, equitable supply chain and cared for farmers, but they're just not doing it quickly enough and with enough sense of urgency. So that's the point where that's where we can really bite with them. And then the honest answer is come and join us and join Tony's Open Chain. I think if the likes of Mars or Nestle, they're not going to join a competitor's. They're not going to join Tony's Open Chain, and we know that. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it their own way. And so they should, because they are huge, successful organizations who have the power and the capability to do it well. So we can be a bit more provoking with the big guys, whereas the small, medium, there's still a huge amount of those who we can actually help solve it with our solution.
I love that. Thank you. And you know, I mean, as a marketing tactic for folks tuning in, you know, as part of your strategy, that picking your enemy can be immensely powerful. But also, you know, to everything you've spoken to, you know, drawing that line and figuring it out. I just love how you've thought about that. There's also been a lot of comments in the chat about, like, the consistency across the products. And so one final question for me, and I genuinely will get to folks, but you've just moved from a CMO to a CPO role,
so
Chief Product Officer role. So what's that transition been like? Because that consistency of the product, for example, the advent calendar, the shape of the chocolate bar and stuff like that, presumably falls under your remit now.
It did originally.
I did it as well. Okay, so what was the conversation like about finding those consistency points and sort of really making sure that brand goes all the way through the product? Because I think a lot of people would dream of that, you know, not a surface level brand, but like one that goes all the way through. I'd just love to find out a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, isn't it? And the honest answer is when I joined Tony's, we didn't have it codified. So it was literally this wonderful lady called Ava, who has been with Tony's for 15 years and who made the caramel sea salt flavor on her internship. And then around. So she's in our product team. And it would basically be, does this feel like Tony's, Ava? She'd be like, nah. Oh, yeah, let's do that. So because you remember, we were still relatively small, like it was done through people and communication and kind of gut feel. And what we've done in the last couple of years is written down what are the product principles and how do we make sure we deliver on that chunkiness and that combination of flavors, and how do we build in our mission into either the packaging or the product at many touch points and build in that element of surprise. So we now have kind of four or five checkpoints that that we go through and we're developing.
I love that. And as Mel says, interns can change companies given the right level of trust and support. But yeah. I also want to just highlight to the community, like the growth. So I reflect on the journey of TMM, and I'm not trying to make this about us at all, but like, we've had many, many years of doing things about gut and sort of figuring out how to do it. And that transition point of just writing down 5 points as a checklist, you know, and sort of saying, are we ticking this off? That's so accessible to everyone watching it today as like as a marketing thing. And we often speak about market research and everything that goes with it. But at those beginning stages, a bit of gut, you know, goes a long way, which is awesome. It's just lovely to hear, because of course, so many people, I mean, the chat feature is ridiculous right now with people just singing praises of Tony's. And it's, you know, it's clear that you've grown to be building something special, but that starts from gut feel, which is just lovely.
Gut feel and passion, doesn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. Spot on. Human stuff.
Yeah.
Right. let's head to the Q&A from the community, because I've been promising that for the past 7 minutes. So the first one comes from Kirsty. So this may have predated your time at Tony's, but maybe you'll have some knowledge on it. So Kirsty asks, if there was no paid media for the first 15 years, could you give any detail on the tactics that particularly worked during that period of time?
Yeah, of course I can do. So the first thing that worked, I mean, our bar has been our biggest marketing tool. I mean, it's bright colours, the way it stands out on shelf, the way the unequally dividedness tells a story, how we've written on the inside of the wrapper that tells a story that invites people to share it. It tastes amazing, so people buy it again, share it with their friends and share the story behind. So ultimately, just through trial and word of mouth is what's grown it to start with. But at the same time, we've done a huge amount of sampling. So tasting is believing. So in the Netherlands, they have this thing called we have it in the UK, but the postcode lottery in the Netherlands is huge. So Tony's bar became a prize in the postcode lottery. So we managed to do a huge amount of sampling because of that. And then equally in the UK, we've done a lot of sampling with HelloFresh and some other kind of with social media. So again, getting bars into people's hands has been our number one marketing strategy and still continues to be so, because tasting is believing, and then we get the repeat and we get the awareness off the back of that. The other thing that we've done, particularly in the Netherlands, as I've talked about this, the brand grew up through Turn and his story in the newspapers, and that very much carried on with some of the political lobbying that the brand did around fair supply chain practices and around some other kind of a little bit controversial thing, stunts that they did, essentially got them a disproportionate amount of earned media. So, but broadly speaking, it's been bars in people's hands through sampling and some earned media that's got it to where it is. And just looking, I think also you mustn't forget how different it looks to, I mean, the rainbow colour that puts on shelf, it's a real billboard for the brand. So I think the visibility that you have in store has made a big difference.
That's huge. I mean, it just really, you know, there was a quote from, I think it was a Ritson article quite recently that sort of said, your product is still your best form of marketing, you know, which, you know, is sort of speaks to everything, you know, or at least the first part of your answer there. Interesting with the colors, actually, because the logo presumably is something you consider a distinctive brand asset, if we start in terms such as that. Yeah. Is the color palette the same, or do you literally just go, we're going to find something bright?
Well, you've toppled onto a big project we're working on at the moment, because we've got so many colors and consumers are shocked by color. So I like the orange one, I like the purple one. I mean, quite honestly, running out of colors. And we've got too many shades actually similar. So yes, so I haven't even got our red bar, which is with me at the moment. But yes, they all look and feel like this. They're all bright. We hate a pastel. So that's no pastels allowed. Fluorescents, great. Big, bold, bright colors, brilliant. No pastels. So I've forgotten your question, Joe. I started blabbing on about
No, just whether bright colors is your distinctive brand asset, or whether or not you just pick something bright and neon.
No, well, the two colors that started with were a milk bar and a dark bar. And in the Netherlands, where the brand started, the milk bar was dark blue and the dark bar was red. And that was very much the category code. And when Tun developed them, he did the opposite. So red became milk and blue became dark. So those two colors are kind of the, I guess, mama and papa of the product range and the starter kit, and everything else is growing from there. And then we now have kind of a six SKU core rainbow, which is our kind of six SKUs that we think should be kind of every shelf across the world. And then we have a selection of other kind of rotating flavors or the Ben & Jerry's type bars or kind of new introducing to keep that relevance and newness coming through regularly. And then we are drastically searching for more colors.
I'm imagining, a Tony's insert color here, a bit like a Tiffany's blue, Tiffany's blue. That's what I think. I love it. Yeah. Let's take the next question from the incredible Mel Barfield. So Mel asks, how does Tony's marketing department dance that line between calling out Big Coco mm-hmm. and avoiding the wrath of the legal teams of the companies?
So we love. So yes, that's a really good point. And it is that tension in the business. And it's not actually with our legal teams. We didn't have a lawyer until 3 months ago. So we didn't have a legal team. but Katerina's now getting very close to us. The actual tension that we touched on a minute ago was between how we can be bold and provocative as a marketing team versus our Tony's Open Chain Heat team, who are trying to be inviting and welcoming and being together. So that's actually the tension that we have to kind of park that line on. And to be honest, there's two things that happen. Firstly, they were very intertwined, Tony's Open Chain and Tony's, for a long time, and we're trying to pull them apart slightly as two separate brands, still under the same roof, but so that we can have a different tone of voice and play a slightly different role in this story. And then the second answer is it just again comes down to human connection. So we'll come up with an idea that we think is pretty punchy. We'll run it past the Open Chain team, who go kind of an ashen shade of grey. And then we have a bit of a conversation and see how we can soften it or talk more about urgency and time rather than another lens. And then the honest answer is that they are paying the fair price for Coco, and there is no way to hide that. So we can be really strong and bold, and the Tony's Open Chain team are fine about that. They're not paying a higher price. Yes, you can shout and scream that from the rooftops. There's certain topics that we can be really, really punchy on, and so we kind of stick to those.
I love that. I mean, I think that speaks to presumably, a sense that you are doing right, and therefore one of the comments in the chat earlier was like, that's such brave marketing, but like maybe it doesn't feel brave to you because it just feels right. Is that a sense within the team, or do you feel you need to sort of push the boat out and feel a little bit brave?
I think sometimes you do have to sometimes feel brave. I remember launching the advent calendar and having it in my diary. We're on day 8, which for the day there'd be no chocolate, and just thinking, oh my goodness, how is this going to go? So there's not every moment you think, yeah, we've totally nailed this. We're absolutely on the right side of that line. Yeah. You still have the, I've done all my work, I've convinced myself and all the stakeholders this is the right thing to do, but I still need to take a deep breath. So yeah, 8th of December 2022 is going to be in my mind.
and did you get it? Did you get a bunch of feedback from folks?
Loaded. Absolutely loaded, yes. So I'm like mostly positive, and then occasionally just some really, really cross people as well. So yeah.
That's just interesting. There's Rob in the chat here is sort of speaking about the bold purpose or the bright colorful tastiness and stuff like that, and again it just sort of speaks to everything that hopefully you've got across so far, which is that idea that it's about the chocolate first, and so there'll be still some people who don't get it despite the incredible purpose behind it, which is
yeah And that's fine, because ultimately they're still making a difference by buying a chocolate and enjoying it. They're still making a difference to those cocoa farmers. I'd like them to know, but if they don't actually mind and just want to eat the chocolate for good chocolate, happy days, they're still making a difference. So
hang on, love it. And we've got Amy offering some sympathy in the chat, who said, I really felt for you that day. It was hella brave, but I can only imagine the amount of stuff you had to deal with. So you had some sympathy right there. Let's take the next question from Nada, who asks, how much of Tiny's marketing budget is allocated to your expected growth and brand building channels versus mission building / system change efforts? I appreciate this is part of the brand building, but I feel different to classic brand awareness efforts. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah. So we split it into two things. We split it into brand awareness and issue awareness. So what's growing the Tony's brand and what's talking about the problems in cocoa? And we broadly have a kind of 60-40 split with more against issue awareness than brand awareness.
Well, that's, you know, perhaps not surprising, but, that's again.
The beauty is when you do both, isn't it? I mean, that's when the real magic happens. So there's been some examples. I mean, the Ben & Jerry's one was a good one where we're talking about brand awareness, we're talking about issue awareness, we're talking about a great product. Like, that was the holy trinity of everything. Yeah. So then we put all of our money against that. And there is not a lot of money to go around because we pay our farmers fairly, but we're still trying to be competitive on the shop, on the shelves. There's not a lot left at the bottom of the P&L, unfortunately. But that's when it all comes together, that's amazing. We do sometimes have to choose, are we talking about mission? Are we talking about taste? Are we talking about NPD? And what's our comms message?
Yeah, I love that. And for anyone interested, there was actually a presentation way back when about how to build a communications plan, where the folks from Ben & Jerry's actually spoke about it from the other side. So I'll link that in the follow-up email, because gave a step-by-step and showed some examples of how that campaign worked together. Yeah. Let's take the next question from Emma. So Emma says, the strategy is so well put together and the story is so coherent with what you're doing and producing. How long did it take to get to this point, and do you continuously review this?
Good question. I'm going to ask the second part first. Do we continue review it? Yes. So I think any strategy needs a re-look at as soon as you learn something new. And we're learning new things the whole time. So yes, we continually renew it. And then how long did it get to? So I think it's evolved quite a lot. I mean, the mission's always been very much part of the brand. And that I inherited, I guess. And then how we bring that to life, that has evolved over the years. Kind of like I said, when I started, nothing was written down. It was all in people's heads and hearts. So actually trying to translate that into some clear choices and a clear plan going forwards has been kind of the biggest thing that I've been doing. And just like I said, once we've done that, something else happens. We go, oh, okay, well, we now just need to pivot over here slightly. So yeah, it never sits still. But I think we've now got to a place, we're getting to a place at least, where we're clear on the kind of golden principles. And our big choices.
Yeah.
Never stay still. I mean, if you've seen cocoa prices recently, nothing's staying still at the moment.
Well, no, you were speaking about that as a challenge at the beginning. So maybe to loop together the idea of the cocoa prices changing, but also with what you've just said about the sort of consistency and people holding it in your head and heart. You've been at Tony's long enough, presumably, to see quite a lot of change. And like, how do you sort of keep that sense of bravery, that sense of agility, for want of a less horrible marketing term, when presumably the organization is growing and like bureaucracy starts coming in and stuff like that. How are you facing up to that particular challenge at the moment?
Yeah, and it's a really good point. So the business is exploding, our growth is amazing, but we do have, we've got quite a young team, which means that people at that stage of the career where they move on quite regularly. So we have actually, I mean, we had an all hands meeting last year, and we asked people to stand up if they've been in the company less than 12 months, and literally it felt like the entire room students. And I was like, gosh, I've been here 3 years and now I'm one of the old timers. So how do you keep, when you've got all these new people coming in, how do you keep that bravery, that boldness, that edginess and that agility? I think it comes down to a couple of things. It comes down to what screening we recruit against. So as well as looking for kind of capability in the function we're recruiting for, we also recruit against what we call a resilient shaper. So that is our phrase for people, who we want, who can come in and, Tony's, when you join it, it's a bit like a wind tunnel. There is so much going on. It's so busy and everything is constantly changing. So you have to be that person who can deal with that ambiguity and deal with that change and be cool with that. Mm-hmm. And then also shape. So can you bring your ideas? Can you bring your thoughts? And can you shape it into whatever piece of the business is yours? Can you shape that into a better version of what it was before? So that's the kind of screen that we look at when we're looking for new people to join. And then the second thing is when people join Tony's, they get really immersed into the brand and the business. So they'll sit down, they'll come to our product kitchen, they'll watch it, they'll make their own chocolate bar with the products team. They'll sit down with Clink, who's kind of been part of the brand director for a number of years, and he will talk to them through what is Tony's, what is a Tony's, this is how you make it look and feel. And we give examples of when we've done brave, bold, challenger brand marketing and kind of hero those moments. So, but it all comes down to people and connection.
It just seems so healthy, like the organizational culture. And I guess I'm relating and got empathy and sympathy for folks who are watching in right now who are like, you know what, I've got a boss who maybe doesn't understand marketing or isn't on board with the branding, or we don't have that consistency across these things. I mean, maybe asking this outside of a Tony's context or within a Tony's context, you know, as a marketing leading person, how do you sort of work through that journey with folks when you don't have this consistency that Tony's quite clearly does?
Oh, it's tricky, isn't it? And I think if you're not the leader in that team, then I think what I do think you can do is to be the leader for the bit that you are. Everybody's responsible for something, whether you're here or here. And I think you can still bring your own kind of professional pride to your work, no matter this kind of size and scope that you have. So I guess just because you don't have that around you, it doesn't mean you can't be a leader within your team. So I would just encourage everyone not to be kind of disheartened in that situation, but kind of control what you can control and own your bit and make sure it's shit hot. And then you'll find that that's just attractive to other people, and you'll never know the kind of impact that you can have because of that.
No, I love that. And Mel has popped in the chat jobs in case anyone is looking.
You know, love them, yeah.
Bang on. I love that. And similarly, we've got Jade in the chat sort of saying, can we all come and work at Tony's? So I think we're doing a good thing for the employer brand as much as the brand today, which is lovely. Let's take one of the questions from the top. Question from Amanda, who says, what's been the reaction of the big players to your challenge to the industry? Is there any collaboration in sight? So you've spoken already a little bit.
Mondelez, issued a bit worse, which clearly we're not their best friends at the moment. So what are we noticing? So it comes back to my point of they all agree that's where we should be heading. Mm-hmm. They're just not doing it quickly enough.
Yeah.
So have we seen enough action yet? No. The honest answer is no, we're not seeing enough action for the big guys. What we are seeing is a kind of groundswell of small to medium size cocoa sourcing companies, particularly off the back of Ben and Jerry's. That was a real kind of tipping moment where everyone went, wow, you're the real deal. There'll be some news coming out in the next kind of few months about some exciting kind of mission allies in the UK. There's one in the US. So we're starting to see kind of a groundswell from enough of the smaller and medium-sized companies that the bigger we get, the more pressure that we can apply. Nice. But yeah, nothing's happening quickly enough. We're very impatient.
Impatience is good in this context.
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely, you know, it's genuinely life-changing stuff. I wanted to pick up on your comment about Ben and Jerry's there, because that being a tipping point moment, and I guess quite a lot of folks watching in today will from time to time have these moments where they go, oh, here's a spot of momentum, you know, that comes out of nowhere. It could be a campaign that works well, or I don't know, a random shout out from an influencer or something like that.
Yeah.
So in Tony's Towers, what did it look like where you kind of had that moment of realization that this was...
We've been working on it for so long. So it's one of those things that felt like an anticlimax, but it actually came because we'd had so many sleepless nights over it. So it was essentially getting... The first part was getting Ben and Jerry's... They'd come to us and said, we want to learn about Tony's Open Chain. How can we help? What can we do together? And we thought, brilliant. And then you end up writing, and you're then working with an amazing brand, but it's also owned by Unilever. So you end up with Unilever lawyers who are lovely people, but like really long legal contracts. So we got very tied up in some very long, complicated legal contracts that took forever to get signed by the right people in the right places. And so that took us months and months and months. And during that time, we've been working on the kind of NPD and the brand campaign, because we knew as soon as it was signed, we're like, well, that will be then our trigger to get this going. And then we had to do the license agreement with Unilever, which again, I'm not a lawyer, and long contracts are not my favorite thing. But I have pages and pages and pages of these license agreements. Anyway, once we finally got all of that kind of locked and loaded, we can then go on with the fun stuff and come up with the flavours and come up with a campaign. And I mean, that just felt amazing. Like announcing that to the world with Ben and Jerry's and their power and voice, particularly in the US where we are still a very small brand, was just amazing. And to get to work with their marketing team was fascinating. And I went to talk to the Ben and Jerry's board and called them the story I just told you. So yeah, it was amazing. We had a big celebration at Choco Central, our kind of head office, because it really felt like it was the coming together of two really symbiotic, amazing brands for a really important mission. So just the whole stars aligned. Mm-hmm. And as well as going to consumers and launching these amazing products and talking about why we're celebrating together from an industry perspective, as soon as someone as big as Ben and Jerry's, backed by Unilever, joins Tony's Open Chain, it gave us real credibility. Yeah. And we were no longer just this annoying mosquito in the room. We then actually had some substance to it. So it was a real tipping moment for us as a business and a brand and for our mission. So,
yeah. I love it. It's just fabulous. I want to pick up on a chat comment here from Amy, because there's people applauding it. So Amy says, I think businesses need to see that it is possible to do things ethically and turn a profit. So the more you can do to spotlight these other businesses, the more other businesses will see it's possible. I guess as we're drawing to a close, I'd like to open really, you know, a real big open question, which is this idea of how we can start to build marketing functions or businesses that feel like it does both. And I feel like throughout hopefully today's session, we've touched on all these themes, but if we were to try and bring everything together into, you know, sort of a couple of minutes of reflection on, you know, how one can both do commercial and also purpose, I'd love to hear your open thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I love that. I can't remember exactly. Was it Mary who said it? But the way you phrased it was beautiful.
Amy.
Yeah. my sister's called Mary, so I was feeling. So I think it's so important, and it's something that we constantly have to remind ourselves at Tony's, because in order for people to realize how possible this is, they have to be inspired from all different angles. So you have to be inspired from a doing something good, but also running a successful commercial business. Because if you just do one without the other, nobody's going to copy you. So we have this phrase, we're not a chocolate distribution charity. So when something comes up that is commercially stupid, mm-hmm. we go, we're not a chocolate distribution charity. Nobody is going, we're not going to inspire that wider change. If we remember that three pillar strategy, which is inspire wider change, we're not going to inspire that wider change, be that in the chocolate industry or be that across the world, to be both a good business and a big business, unless you are also a profitable big business. You have to have them both together. So it's tough, but that's what kind of a really, really drives me, the desire to show that you can be both good and big, not just one or the other. And there's so many movements out there. I mean, I'm a massive fan of B Corp. There's so many amazing brands, and that seems to be getting a huge amount of momentum at the moment. And the Better Business Act going, and it's kind of been trying to get through the UK Parliament. There's a lot of stuff happening here, but I think it's so, yeah, it's critical. If we're going to change the way that we run our world, we have to be able to be both good and successful.
Beautiful. Thank you, Jo. I really appreciate you speaking to that. And I think that's just a lovely way to bring a close to today's session. So thank you so much. Wonderful storytelling at the beginning, and likewise for taking the questions from myself and the community. The chat throughout has just been unreal. So thank you also to everyone watching in for such a brilliant session. You're endlessly appreciated every single week. So you're just the absolute best. Also, a big thank you once again to our sponsors, just as a final shout out for them today. To Frontify Exclaimer, Cambridge Martin College and Redgate. These sessions don't happen without these folks, so a big thank you to them. Once again, you'll get those in the follow-up email. Say thank you. It makes the world of difference. With all that said, we're back next Tuesday with the Chief Communications Officer for Manchester United, speaking all about leadership, no matter your job title, which was in fact one of your answers today, Joe. So that was really, really great. With all that said, thank you very much. Hope to see you next week, and take care, everyone. You're the absolute best, and I hope you have a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant day. Take care.